This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, April the 10th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Podcast today is brought to you by all of the patrons on Patreon. Patreon is a place for creators, essentially supporting the podcast in some kind of a monetary way. There's donors of $2 per month. There's donors of $25 per month. I think there's even a donor of $35 per month. So really, whatever it is that you feel like contributing gets invested back into the show, essentially. So it costs money to publish the podcast. I invest a couple hours per week on the podcast, maybe a little bit more on some weeks, you know, booking guests, things like that. I'm actually saving the Patreon cash right now to get a new microphone. There's a couple of microphones that I want. This is a handheld, and right now I'm on my way back from Bellingham, Washington. I'm driving home right now, and I'm out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. But there's a headset microphone that, for some reason, to plug into my Zoom H4n recorder, which is what I use, it takes a really special like XLR cable, and having it be really good quality in order to be a headset mic is more than I feel like it should be. But nevertheless, that's what the current dollars to Patreon are going towards, is some equipment upgrades. And then eventually it'd be awesome to get a Zoom H6n recorder, which basically would give me the ability to do interviews with, I think, three people at one time, as opposed to one person right now. So I feel like that could be a really cool thing too. There's been a couple instances where it would be nice to have more than one person as an interview. So thanks to all the Patreons of the, or all the patrons of the show. You can go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. I also wanted to invite you to leave an iTunes review if you're listening on an Apple device. Super easy to do it. You just click on the podcast. You scroll down to write a review, click 5 stars, and then you can write a little written testimonial. You can also write reviews on Facebook. And by the way, I have a poll up on a Facebook group. So there's 136 or 37 members in the Mind and Fitness Podcast, Deleters of Pain is what I call us. But basically, that's the, I'm currently collecting a community on there, and I have a poll running right now where if I were to open up one-on-one coaching for a very limited number of people, I'm talking maybe 5. To start with, basically like a low introductory type of a rate for one-on-one coaching, just basically a sample size. I'm opening it up there to a handful of people. So I think 3 or 4 people have already voted yes that they would want to take that on. So it's certainly an option that's available to the fans of the podcast. So this week, though, actually let's recap last week a little bit. So Caitlin Michaels was on the show last week. We finally did the joint simulcast of the Mind Body Mastery Podcast and the Mind and Fitness Podcast. I thought it went awesome. We got a chance to answer a whole bunch of questions from listeners of both of our shows, and we didn't get to all of them. However, the plan is to get together in the month of May and do an in-person podcast. As good as our chemistry is over Skype, I feel like it would be even better by doing it in person, which is the plan when I come out to the Midwest here in the next month and a half. So that's kind of what's coming down the pike. Also, I wanted to take a chance take an opportunity to plug Nicole Sachs's most recent podcast. She did one on Friday that says, I think it was, TMS is not a mental health issue, basically, but she really and very succinctly in a 25-minute podcast, as good of a description as I've heard on what's going on physiologically in heightened fight or flight, which is what TMS is. So go and listen to that. It's Nicole Sachs. So you just type in Nicole and then Sachs, and you can find that pretty much, I think, wherever podcasts can be found. But an Apple device for sure, and Audio Boom for sure. It would be worth your time to listen to, so go check that out. As far as this week goes, I have a killer interview with Andy. Andy Bayless, who actually came to me. I think he was a listener of the podcast, but essentially he liked what he heard. He got in touch with me. We emailed back and forth, and basically he was somebody who was having chronic pain issues, got diagnosed with neuropathy in his feet, and Ultimately was able to heal himself, and now he coaches people at TMSPainRelief.com. But he is he's down in Oregon, and it was a really cool conversation. I felt like this was much more of a conversation as opposed to an interview, which, you know, great interviews are conversations, but there was a lot of, like, anecdotal storytelling on my side, too, because there was just so much he was saying that was resonating, and that I felt like I could really add some greater benefit for people to listen to. So that's what's coming up today on the show. This open, I'm just going to keep it short because Andy and I went an hour 5 and hour 10, so we'll keep this open here to 5 or so minutes. But wanted to thank everybody for your support. Feel free to send me an email, DM me, whatever, if you want to check me out or talk directly. And like I said, if you are interested in doing one-on-one coaching, easiest way is to go to Facebook, get added to the group, the Mind and Fitness Podcast, the Leaders of Pain, and then just vote on that poll because that's where I'm going to take the name. So there's 3 or 4 on there right now that are ready to go for coaching, and I will get hooked up with the other ones. Here's a podcast with Annie Bayless. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week.
Yeah, I've got a little rain on my roof. I don't think that's going to be too loud. But
No.
Thank goodness we're close to nature. You've got an open window, and I've got rain on my roof.
That's right. No. It's perfect. And by the way, like, the way that I've been doing these interviews lately is essentially not telling the interviewee when it is that we're actually recording, and then we'll and then it'll just air. And I feel like it's a much more spontaneous sounding conversation, which is cool. Just two guys sitting at the bar is kind of how I like to look at it.
Okay, well, that's probably part of your magic, Eddie.
You know, funny story. Okay, so in Skype it says you're in Ashland. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. Ashland. So a funny story about Ashland. I have, it's near and dear to my heart, sort of. But we moved from Chico, California, to Edmonds, Washington, in 1995, 1996-ish, and, you know, we loaded up a U-Haul and all this kind of stuff, and we got to. Basically, I was riding in the U-Haul with my dad. My mom was in a separate car. And he starts smelling smoke. We pulled over. We're on the side of the freeway in Ashland. And the brakes had caught fire. And then, like, a wheel caught fire. And my dad, there was no – U-Haul didn't load a fire extinguisher into the truck. So he used a glove and tried to smatter out the – he eventually did get the fire stopped. But they ended up having to bring another U-Haul onto the interstate and literally unload one and load up the other on the side of the freeway with, you know, 20 years of stuff in the back. And so anytime I see Ashland on a map or anybody talks about it, I think about our U-Haul being on fire. And ironically, that's where you're calling out of, which is
wow. Small
world.
Yeah.
Huh?
puts a place on the map for you. And how old were you then?
I would have been 9 or 10. It's pretty young. Yeah, pretty young. But it's pretty vivid. I remember that. I remember that pretty well. But, you know, it's the adventure stories of our lives that you know, ultimately lead to cool conversations in other parts of life. So
That's right.
Okay, so people listening, to give you some background, I at the end of most shows, I post something and I ask, hey, if you've got a cool story to tell, shoot me an email. I'd love to hear about it. And Andy was so nice and sent over some of his story a while back, and it took us a little bit of time for me to get the response there and get the thing scheduled, because he reached out in mid-February, and then I finally got it. You know, life's busy, right? I got a 1-year-old, I got a 4-year-old, I you know, all that kind of stuff. But I'm happy that we got it together. And pretty much, like, for me, and I think a lot of the people listening, it's sort of like the worst symptoms they can imagine, almost like the better the story is, I feel like. And it doesn't have to be that way, but you've got a heck of a story. So maybe we'll start with I don't know. Do you want to Tarantino this and start from now and go backwards, or do you want to start from the beginning? What would be your preference? What's your favorite way to tell, you know, what happened to you and what got you to where you're at now?
I think starting at the beginning, and maybe, you know, sometimes parenthetically might mention that the common experiences with other people, but I think your background is so rich on this that you can also make those connections, because I think it's important that folks listening can relate to my story and maybe have some questions answered as they go along, or questions asked in their own mind.
Definitely. No, I think that sounds like a good plan. Well, you sent me your story via email, you know, starting with the disabling foot pain and going to the different healers and dropping us a good amount of cash on this stuff. But tell us the story. Pretend you never even emailed me and we just bumped into each other on an elevator and you had a sign on your back that said, "I've read Dr. Sarno." What would you say? What would be the story?
Yeah, I guess I'd say that I had increasing foot pain. I was not sure what it was about. Coming into this, very athletic person. I think the year before this started, I was a wilderness ranger out in eastern Oregon for the BLM, hiking and backpacking. I've been a ski mountaineer all my life, expeditions and glacier crossings, and love being outdoors on my feet for my fun and my work. And then I'm starting to have increasing foot pain, and I just go to the usual route, go to a podiatrist and get some stretches, and then it doesn't work, so he's giving me orthotics, and then the next two or three years of just increasing anxiety, increasing symptoms, and increasing treatments, expensive treatments start, like so many others on this path. I ended up when you hear the people list what they've done, you know, I'm just a classic that way. I had, by the time I was done after 3 years of doing this, I had, I think, 6 or 8 different surgeons ready to operate on me. They were sure what I had was either first plantar fasciitis, then they thought it might have been tarsal tunnel, which is a form of nerve entrapment down in the, near the ankle. And then finally, I was diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy, and then I had blood tests that showed that was idiopathic, you know, meaning that they couldn't really find a reason for it. And finally, I can give you some more of the details. And I mean, I live in a town where there's a lot of alternative healers, and so we have kind of the best Chinese medicine, the best chiropractors, the best, you know, all these alternatives. So I went through the medical system and then on the alternative healers, and was really scheduled for surgery, had increased my insurance coverage at that time and was scheduled for surgery. When I reluctantly took a couple of Sarno's books out to the desert in my camper and just decided I would meditate deeply on this method, which I really did not believe in, but I would do that before I ended up getting, quote unquote, cut on. And so I can give you some more details in all the treatments that I tried, but that's the short piece. And the common pieces are just the endless search for the cure, the anxiety. I got on airplanes to go visit better surgeons because I didn't want the wrong one to cut me.
Yep.
At some point I was traveling across Oregon 300 miles back and forth once a week to see the best sports medicine chiropractor, again, to avoid surgery. I ended up with blood platelet injections down in L.A. with a podiatrist that took my blood, and I didn't use my foot for 2 months along the way and tried resting, 3 different pairs of orthotics, Gua Shan, Egoscue, layer upon layer of fruitless efforts.
What year approximately, like what's the range when this is happening?
This started in 2010.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So pardon me. 2009 is when it started.
So platelets, the PRP treatment was probably pretty new at that time. There's been a lot of, and for anybody that doesn't know, platelets, the PRP treatment he's talking about, this has been, it's been a hot issue in sports medicine for a while. Hines Ward, for instance, used it, the famous wide receiver for the Pittsburgh Steelers, basically He had an acute injury, needed to be ready by the Super Bowl, used PRP to accelerate the healing on it, and then he was able to play in the game. Tiger Woods has used it. There's been a variety of athletes that have used it. It was one of the avenues that I attempted to go down before ultimately the doctor who said, you need to slow down and this isn't about anything that's going on physically, and, you know, completely changed the trajectory of where I was heading. But a lot of the other treatments you talk about, like Gua Sha, if people are not familiar with Gua Sha, if you've been to a chiropractor and a chiropractor has suggested Graston technique, it's the same idea. It's scraping the skin, and the hope is that you're raising blood to the surface and it's helping heal whatever it is, whatever ailment it is that you have.
Yeah, it's great, Eddie, that you know all these, you know, so much of this. And I think that obviously the practitioners in any of these fields, they feel like what they're doing is working. As I looked, I have a 4-page medical history that I have on my website, and I just looked at it this morning, and I realized I wrote down there that the only relief I had was with the local chiropractor here, the only significant relief, and it lasted about 6 hours.
What? The medical history thing is interesting. I've heard that said a couple of times that, you know, writing down this extensive medical history, and towards the end of my doctor jumping, there was a guy who, a doctor who had required upon seeing him, which he did not take insurance, by the way, so I actually never ended up getting to his office, thank God, but they had asked for a complete history, and because it was across so many different doctors, I should send you a copy of this thing when I'm done. I bet it looks just like yours, but yeah, it was somewhere four pages, 6 pages, 8 pages, but it literally had the procedure I had done and or the imaging I had done or the treatment I had done, the name of the doctor, where it was that they worked, what the name of the practice was, all this kind of stuff. And I went back and I read that maybe 6 months ago, and I was just thinking, I can't believe I ever sat down and wrote this whole thing. You know what I mean? And I bet it's just like what you're referencing on your website. Very TMS-y of you.
Well, yeah. And as each practitioner I would go to, I wanted to cut to the chase. Get, you know, the 15 minutes I had with them after an airplane flight, I wanted them to have the history so that they could cure me, you know, like quick. And so you're right, it's very TMSing. It's also something that I have to say, Eddie, I ended up sending, when I finally worked the Sarno method and got better, I sent a copy of this to, I think, 14 different physicians that I had seen, with a letter addressed to each one saying, you know, you can find yourself on this list, and I want you to know what really worked for me, and I want you to take this into your heart for other people that see you.
Did any of them get back to you after that?
No.
No, not surprised. So, all right, well, so you get to, you know, you spend this exorbitant amount of money on these different amount or these different types of procedures and treatments and things like that. You're headed for surgery. You have a couple different diagnoses. Like, what ultimately, and then you sort of jump to the part that I want to hear about, because you mentioned you got the couple of books, you went out to the desert in the camper, and you meditated on this. What happened right before that to get the books in your hand?
Well, it was actually my brother had died, and I was with a boot cast limping around trying to take care of his affairs at about the lowest point in this, in the fall of 2012. And the man who my brother had assigned to help me straighten out his affairs should he die, a wonderful guy named Alex, he kept insisting that what I had was this thing, this Sarno thing. And I resisted it so, so deeply, Eddie. I had done so much spiritual, psychological, in-depth work for 15 years before that, based on some other important events in my life, that when somebody told me it was repressed emotions, I just couldn't believe it. You know, I'm the guy that's taught people how to access their anger, and I'm the guy that knows about my inner workings, and it helped people with that deeply. And so I resisted it so much, and then finally some books arrived in the mail, and beautiful Alex had just sent me these, you know, through Amazon or something, and again I put them aside, and then it was really the last part of it was the deep fear of having them do tissue damage to my body. and that all the stuff I'd heard was, well, you'll never quite be the same, or we could slip, or, you know. And so I thought, you know, there's just got to be a way to get around this without surgery. Also, I would say that my mom and my grandparents on one side, they were Christian Scientists, so there was, and they had some actual kind of quote-unquote miracle healings in the family, so that was part of probably a strand that I was partly consciously aware of too, that gave me some kind of hope in something that wasn't surgical.
It's interesting that you bring up this, that basically this you had a fear of them cutting into the tissue. There's two things I'm thinking of, and there's one where my brother, one of my brothers, is not a fan of this stuff at all. I don't think anyway. And some of the commentary on, like, if I post about any of this stuff, whether it's my podcast or whether it's my interest in it or whether it's the fact that I completely was able to turn my life around on it, or that I've talked to thousands of people around the world now at this point, that also have had these like rapid turnarounds or rapid recoveries, but he's just not a fan of it for whatever reason. And I had a thought, and I was going back, and I had just searched in my like Facebook search. I searched the term MRI, and I found this post of him talking about foot pain from, I don't know, 7 years ago or something. And he had said that the doctor that he met with had said that, let's do surgery, and the best you'll ever get after the surgery is 80%, but 80% is better than where you're at right now. And he never ended up having any sort of a surgery, so I don't know whatever. he doesn't limp around, so I don't know whatever ended up happening of that. So I totally get the tissue damage part. And the other thing I was thinking of is that as we record this, yesterday was the 3-year anniversary of me having I was having a lot of shoulder problems, and I went and got an MRI done at the end of or the beginning of 2016. And took the MRI results to 3 or 4 different doctors, 3 or 4 different surgeons, and they all had a different opinion. They all saw something different in the imaging. None of them could agree on what it was. And I just went with who I felt was the quote-unquote best, and that was because he was the head physician for the Seahawks and head physician for the Mariners and all this kind of stuff. I thought, okay, like, I'm an athlete, they're athletes, he's the best, whatever. Had the surgery, had a complete reconstructive shoulder surgery on my left side. And then I got medically cleared at 4 months and 29 days. And on 4 months and 30 days, so the next day, I had back spasms from the base of my skull to the top of my butt. So my entire back went into spasm, and I'd never had, you know, like, back problems were not something that I ever had outside of, hey, I'm sore from lifting for a few days. And that should have been the first thought to me, was like, whoa, like, I just went through this long shoulder thing, all my problems should be solved, and now it's this back thing. But I had just assumed that I ruptured something or something was totally wrong, and so I started looking into additional surgeries for whatever these problems were. But you know, there is certainly a fear involved, but there also have been a lot of people that have had surgery, a structural change, and still had pain afterwards, went through Sarno's work, and were able to heal and be pain-free to this day. There's a couple schools of thought that I'm thinking of when you talk about that, like a fear of tissue damage from going through a procedure.
Yeah, and I've worked with several people as a life coach doing this work who have had surgery. The pain didn't go away, and then they found Dr. Sarno's method. And often with those folks, there's other emotional work. I don't know if that was, you know, your experience eventually, but there are often feelings of anger at the surgeons, or anger at themselves. You know, anger sort of has to go outward or inward, or disappointment or superego activity that they did this and then it didn't work. And part of the work that I think has been helpful for those folks is to really just accept that you did the best you could, and that you were trying to take care of yourself. And in many cases, surgery does work. So I think it's important for us to have self-compassion for ourselves, no matter what path we take or how long we obsess or worry about symptoms before we find some deep healing.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring that up, because I lately have been doing about 10 minutes of show up and throw it, basically on a piece of paper. I do it on the computer, but it's sort of like journaling, but it's sort of like the listing that Sarna talked about, the mind-body prescription. But and then it's also sort of like the zero pain now method that Adam Heller teaches. But basically, it's a they're very, very short sentences, and they always start with "I feel." And there was a lot of I feel angry at this particular medical practitioner, right? It was a lot of that this morning. So it's interesting that you bring that up and that you say it in that way, because that's something that it was just, you know, for a long time I just sort of felt like bygones be bygones. They're trying to do their best work and it's okay. And though they are trying to do their best work and they're not intentionally giving misleading information, and that's, you know, I don't hate on doctors. I think that they do the best with what they can. They go to school to learn this one thing for years and years and years and years, and they're not getting into medicine to make money. I really don't believe that. However, there is still that burden that falls on the patient that, hey, this modality didn't work, and then you doubt yourself, and then you beat the shit out of yourself for it, which is not really – that's not being helpful to anybody.
Yeah, Eddie, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that because I may have done kind of a psychological bypass to talk about forgiving the physicians, and what you're talking about is just being very real with your feelings around this, and that's obviously the place we have to be moment to moment, even if it's a year later or in the moment. I feel like some of the TMS direction is to forgive, and I think that that's a much more complex and a deeper subject than to just forgive. And so to allow the anger to feel your indignation, your disappointment, that's where to start. And or that's where to cycle back to if it comes up. So I want to be clear with that. And I also want to say another thing about surgeons, if I could, and since we're on that subject.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah. No, go for it.
Well, I think what was really helpful for me, and I can't remember if it was my first trip to the desert or not, or after the first trip, but it began to dawn on me, and I'll give you some more details of the kind of the important pieces there. But at some point, I went to a local surgeon here. You know, you've got to get in a couple months, you got to schedule an appointment, it takes months to get in. And what was so good for him, for me, was that he said to me, well, you might have plantar fasciitis and you might have this tarsal tunnel nerve entrapment, and he said, and we don't know, and so first we would cut on this, release the nerve, and if it didn't work, we would try the plantar fasciitis surgery. And that was such a breath of fresh air to me, Eddie. And I think most people who engage this Sarno method have these epiphanies or these kind of support from their sincere work and inquiry. That was huge for me. He was basically saying he wasn't sure, but he would start cutting and we'll find out over time. The other thing he said to me was, I said to him, well, what's your success rate with this tarsal tunnel, for instance, where they open up this nerve channel on the inside of your near your ankle? He said, oh, I've done about 8 of them, and they're about 50%. And I thought, wow, I love this guy. he's not telling me 99%.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if the other surgeon said that, but you know, it's at least 90, 95. And again, I don't want to cast aspersions on physicians. But it was such a, you know, it was like grace. It was like from the heavens. Okay, this guy, he's not sure. He's very honest with me. And then I said, well, tell me about this. And he said, oh, the one that really worked was on this lineman who climbed poles with those spikes that dig into the wooden pole. He said, yeah, he wore those spikes and climbed telephone poles, you know, which are strapped right on next to where this nerve is.
Yep.
He said, oh, yeah, he did that for about 30 years, and he was hurting. And boy, once we cleaned that up, he felt a lot better. And I thought, well, this isn't me, right? This isn't me at all.
Right.
So I want to say that, that how wonderful that physician was to just be honest.
Yeah, you know, there was when I went back and I saw the, you know, because like I said, I I had the shoulder surgery, I go through rehab, everything's fine. And then the next day I start having even worse problems. At least, you know, I felt like they were worse. And I went back and made another appointment with that same surgeon and was like, what is the deal? I know this isn't about my shoulder. And it was literally like one of my favorite movies when I was in seventh grade was Billy Madison with Adam Sandler. And there's this part in there where the school nurse is checking the kids for head lice, you know, so like they take the, they have like the wooden stick and she takes like maybe a half a second, right? To either you have lice or you don't. And that's it. And that's kind of how he had treated my, this back issue. Like, you could see it, like those erectors beside my spine were massive. Like, you know, they shouldn't look like that. And he took like a half a second look at my back and he said, this is coming from your neck. All right, see you later. And it was just like, oh my God. And like his assistant gave me referrals for like, you know, four different like neuro or back surgeons that were in the area. And then I start making appointments. Then, you know, they tell me they don't have any availability for a month. And then I go home and I'm Googling this for a month. And I mean, it would be really interesting if his response would have been similar to what your doctors had said, where it was like, well, it could be this, it could be that. I don't know if that would have dropped my anxiety about it, but the definitive, this is coming from your neck. And like, I watch sports all the time. I'm a sports guy and I've seen way too many football players, as an example, take a shot to the head where their neck gets compressed and they have a stinger and they can't move anything. And that's what you know, that's the visualization I have in my head when they say it's your neck. And so, yeah, I don't know, that's interesting, but yeah, good on that doctor for, you know, vulnerability is not the right word, but, being able to openly say, hey, I'm not necessarily sure.
Yeah. And I think that, I think that folks that suffer from long-term symptoms, going to many different practitioners, the physicians, I think I would just want to put this out there. There's an unconscious sort of defense mechanism with physicians, where we often get the message as patients that it's that because they can't fix us. And they may be uncertain, but they don't say it, or sometimes they might, or they've tried some different things. We've tried different things as patients. There's this implied it's your fault.
Yep.
As the patient. And I think that's something physicians could benefit by inquiring into, to learn to be honest with themselves. And it can be very subtle. Most physicians would never say that. I think the best we get in this journey is to hear from a physician, I think this is your nerves. I think this is tension. I think this is some events in your life. And then that's a beautiful invitation. But I think that there's a way that this kind of unconscious, and again, I want to say it, lovingly, but kind of blaming the patient is taken deeply into the patient, and it's really not helpful in this whole process. It just magnifies the anxiety. It magnifies superego activity. It's not helpful.
And health anxiety is a real, excuse my language, bitch, because I think it's like so damaging for people, especially like that age of responsibility that Sarno talks about, between like 30 and 60. And for me, like literally it's like I turned 30, a light switch hit and suddenly I was in pain all the time. And it's Google exists now, whereas maybe it would have not been prevalent 20 years ago. So today I feel like it's even a greater problem to kind of have this sort of haphazard response by a physician, and really what that can lead to, and all that kind of stuff. Well, okay, so let's go back to the desert part. You sort of have this pilgrimage with these two books. You go out to the desert. What is it that you do? You said that you spent 15 years guiding people into being able to feel their own anger, yet this was something that had eluded you, and you know went right over your head for the first little bit because you spent all the time with the doctors, and so you do this pilgrimage, if you will, out to the desert with the two books. Like, what happens? What do you do?
I'm using that divided mind as a kind of a Bible for inquiry. I'm going through it I look at the copy now and it has all these notes in the margins and what does he mean by this? And I can't believe that, or, oh, I get it. This connects with this. I've got a journal. I think the divided mind is great because you've got other practitioners that chime in. And so there's more of a sense of support. It's also broader that it talks about other kinds of pain. Sofer's chapter at the end, which he does a lot on foot pain. And so what I really inquired into is what it came down for me, Eddie, was why I don't think this could be happening to me. And that became kind of a central inquiry question. Why is it that I think this can't be happening to me? Why is it I'm so sure? And one of the pieces in the divided mind that really helped me was, forgetting the specifics, but it was somebody who basically says to Dr. Sarno, how could this be happening to me? I've done therapy for 15 years. And Dr. Sarno says, in so many words, yes, you know yourself deeply, but you haven't connected it to my theories. So that was one of the light bulbs that went off for me, Eddie. It was, you know, and I think for everybody, it's these little epiphanies. So that was one of them as I'm reading the book and out in the desert and a lot of time and space. Another one was reading his work about the superego and the inner tension, which is between the inner child and the way we're conditioned to be as an adult and the pressures. And that it was like, oh, so another moment out there was I realized, oh, what he's talking about are these deep inner hell realms that the conscious mind doesn't even want to be aware of. And I know these hell realms. I know these places. And I know, you know, as many times I've been there with great help and helping others go there into deep sadness or deep rage, I know that that's not somewhere that my identity wants to go.
Yep.
So that was really huge for me. I was like, oh, wow. All he's talking about is this is a whole bunch of hell that doesn't want to be felt or want to be conscious. And also I think that, you know, another piece in there is that it threatens our identity. It threatens our identity as a happy, functional person, or it threatens our identity as being a good boy or being the good listener or whatever it is. Our identities are so deep and we are so attached to those identities. I know that from this history of work before this. So that was a big piece. And then I guess I want to say too that I got on the phone with a life coach, and that was my inquiry with him, was why I don't believe this could be happening to me. And it was a beautiful inquiry for me. For about an hour, I just sort of he just listened and gave me space. But what really it boiled down to, Eddie, was that childhood memories came up for me. My role as the oldest brother, my identity that I took on very young as the boy who could do it when my younger brothers couldn't. And what came up was that if I was being taken down to this level by something that was quote-unquote psychosomatic, that really kind of made me a worthless piece of crap, and that my identity of being somebody who was successful and knew themselves and had it together did not allow in this information. And so I want to share that with you and with others, that I think for each person there are these barriers, psychological barriers often, to just allowing the acceptance of this diagnosis, and that was huge for me. And when and I'll finish up that little moment, because it's a beautiful story. I wrote an article about it on my website. I'm getting done with this session. I've cried. I've realized, and part of I think the deeper psychological work for me many times over the years is just realizing all the strategies of the ego to keep itself together and to not feel the deeper material, the helplessness, the feeling of not being loved, the feeling of sadness. And so this was like a wonderful kind of washing through my nervous system partly, and a deep relaxation. It was coming to terms and accepting and loving my history and myself for where I'd arrived in that moment. It was part of what happened.
Was the coach that you're working with, was that his thing? Was TMS, or was this, did you spill your guts in this session? It wasn't to be like TMS related, but it was just more of a realization for you. Like, were they somebody that was not trained? That's not what I mean, but somebody that this is their specialty. This is what they specialize in.
Yeah. And I apologize. I forget his name. He's the one that's in New York, and sells the, Sarno education, kind of staged education, compact disc videos.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
He worked with Dr. Sarno, and again, I apologize. His name isn't in front of me. I recognize him in that article that I wrote. I think his first name is Ken. So that was helpful. So I was being listened to by somebody who'd been through this whole process. And part of his introduction for me was great. He said that now whenever I get in back pain, he said, I realize the source is this deep, unspeakable sadness that I don't want to feel. So when the pain, the severe pain comes up for me, I now am able to access this unspeakable sadness. So that was a beautiful, induction and a support into the session with me.
And for you, is it when you talk about this deep sadness, and you can choose to share as much in depth or as little in depth as you want, but is it more of a thing of like a cognitive recognition, or is it more of a you free write it, or you record it into a recorder? Like, what's your method for, I guess, for cleansing that?
My approach that I've learned from teachers, and I do with myself and with the assistance of friends, or that I do with clients, is very gentle, attuned, going. I would say that the consciousness, the soul, you could say, wants to be felt in its exquisite precision and with attunement. And this is what people find when they journal. Your work this morning or yesterday morning on the anger. And so knowing that, the work that I do is just a gentle going down into what wants to arise, kind of what's called following the thread. And so in this kind of natural, easy process that might take 10 minutes or 20 minutes or half an hour, the barriers to feeling the next level of material or the next felt sense in the body are worked with gently, with working with the superego and working with just the intention and the self-intimacy practices to just be with what's coming up next. So I'm angry right now. So how does this feel in my body? And once we allow this, maybe it's expressed physically or out loud or even through journaling, then the next layer will emerge. It might be a tenderness or a sadness. And then we make room for that. And again, I want to come back to, really, it's our deeper it's our deeper love and beauty and our amazing human organism and psyche that just wants to be felt and discovered at deeper and deeper layers. Sarno's work is so brilliant because it just condenses that there's a whole bunch of stuff down there that isn't felt. And I think for a lot of people in this work, they find that there's just this gentle invitation to feel more and more. And to me, it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing that is life-changing. And I know you've talked about that in some of your work, your changing in your life and so on. That and in the moment, it's a very beautiful. What I say to people is that beneath all of these layers is really love. That's what's down inside of us, but we don't know it. What we're in contact with are the defenses and the layers, and they're very resistant to kind of melting.
Yeah, the divided mind concept, I feel like, is two things. I think it's one of the better. I wish that I don't even think he first used that term until the divided mind, the book, was released. But the concept of it, the basically the pain is occurring at the intersection of the divided mind between the inner child and the superego. And there's a couple ways I look at it. The superego is the referee that's sort of standing in the middle of whatever sort of a conflict there may be. But it brings to mind, like, in its most simple terms. Yesterday I was in the garage and my daughter was in there with a friend of hers. She's 5, he's maybe 3. And she was eating like applesauce with a spoon. And she has the applesauce on the spoon and then flings it at me unintentionally, hit me on my jacket, like, you know, this big spatter of applesauce. And I remember in that particular moment, I was thinking, like, how annoyed, how frustrating that is to be splashed with applesauce. But then the referee that's watching this whole thing, the superego, says, you know, she's a kid and her friends in there watching, like, it's not a big deal, Eddie, all this kind of stuff. But to me, like, just the recognition that conflict exists between, you know, between basically what it was that I was feeling in the moment versus what it is that the referee wants me to feel or wants me to think, to me is enough to drop it, right? It's not a big deal. But the fact that I recognize that it was there, I don't know, it's very, very subtle. When I talk to people about this that have no idea of the Sarno work, the concept of the divided mind, that's where I feel like they look at me like I have lobsters crawling out of my ears, right? That something like this even exists. I don't know, and I almost feel like maybe in some cases, the worse the illness or issue or injury or how worse the pain is or how deep the issue actually is really pretty reflective on how big that conflict is happening in the divided mind. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. And I want to respond to what your work and your moment with your daughter. It's so beautiful what you're saying, because you're feeling the urge to be angry, or you're actually feeling the anger. You're also seeing the kind of referee, as you call it, and acknowledging that. So it's not running you unconsciously in the moment. You're aware of it. And then you're saying, oh, okay, this is this common activity, these two parts of me, and this is the source. This can be or is a major source of inner tension, and you're acknowledging it all, you're seeing it, and then you're letting it go. And so that's a beautiful thing. And I heard you talk on another podcast about, so it's there's the superego, we're not going to make it go away, and we're not going to fix it necessarily, but we can just simply acknowledge its workings. And I think that, again, for me out in the desert, that was important for me to just, because I know I have a vicious superego, and I think most people that have TMS have a pretty active superego. It's common with everybody, but I think the goodist and the perfectionist mean that the superego is, you know, I don't know if it's fair to say particularly active, but maybe somehow causes more pain. I think in folks that have TMS, there's also a lot of sensitivity. There's kind of an inner permeability, which has to do with empathy for others, kind of just your awareness of it, Eddie. That is, when you know the superego exists and you see it in yourself, you begin to see it in everybody around you. But you realize that most people don't realize that they even are being partially kind of run by it. And so there's a kind of, and then working with clients, there's layer upon layer of the depths of that. And I think somewhat I worked with somebody the other day, and they worked with a lady for a couple months, and she said, now I realize that I have freedom in my life. I didn't used to realize that I could do, that I had so many choices in life. And what she's, and from this side of things, she saw that for decades, she was really trying to meet superego ideals all the time with her work, with her family, her appearance. And from this other side, she realizes that she was completely run by her superego for decades, and that she learned it as a child to stay in the field of love of her parents, and it's natural. But so with many people, it's such a huge issue.
I'm thinking about so. What was I? It was something about the client that you had talked about, but I mean, basically, the concept of the referee, I feel like is it's an interesting way of certainly looking at it, but I feel like it's the really the way that it is. And actually, the so many choices in life. That's what I was thinking about. I couldn't agree more. In fact, I was in Palm Springs last week with my wife, and it was a work trip for her. Not really a work trip, but. 95% of it was designed to be pleasure and relaxation and all this. But I am there with her company, and I remember like years ago, if there was like a free day, and normally like the good husband totally wants to just sit by the pool with his wife, and that even if we're just not going to be talking to each other, but literally just sitting by the pool and drinking a beer or whatever, or even just sleeping literally like in a lounge chair. And I remember thinking like 3-4 years ago, or even 2 years ago, I probably would have done that as much as I really don't want to just sit there by the pool and have that be it. So, but I was just like, no, like, dude, you got choices. And so I took an Uber 25 minutes away and rented a Harley and went and drove a Harley for 7 hours, like throughout the California desert, because that was a lot more fun to me, and I had the option to do it. And I remember thinking, like, is it such a? And I feel like I have these moments all the time. I've never heard anybody say it the way that you're describing your client did. But yeah, like I have felt prior to this, to discovering this kind of work, like I am really stuck and I don't have options. For example, if I was ever like in a job search or a job hunt, I would say to the interviewer that I must come in at 6 in the morning. I must leave at 2:30 in the afternoon because I must get to the gym for the 3 o'clock class or the 3:30 class. And this is the way that it's going to be. And I would like call restaurants in advance to make sure that they have the kind of dietary restrictions that I need. Like everything needs to be just so. And in the last couple of months, it's just sort of been like, it doesn't have to be just like that. Like, if you've got 24 moving hours in a day, like you can move some shit around and like you can, you can accommodate yourself. And if you need to sleep a little bit more, you can take the day off of the gym. It doesn't really like life is just a little bit, it's not as serious as you're making it out to be, I guess is maybe the way that I can best describe that. But the motorcycle story in the desert, that's totally makes me think about what your client was explaining to you as far as choices go. And both sides of me, the superego and the id, were very happy to go and ride a Harley in Palm Desert for 7 hours.
See, isn't that beautiful? You even gave your superego a ride. I mean, that's such a great, such a great story. And I, And I just feel like I'm out in the desert with you doing that. And like all of a sudden, I just feel space and air and wind and choice and freedom. And you're right. My experience of superego is so serious. It's so, you know, I think of like, used to be a school teacher and the kids on the playground as a five-year-old when the superego is developing. You know, for them, it's all black and white. It's like Tommy's doing it wrong, period. And so that's really the way the superego looks at life, is very, very serious. And I love your, I heard a podcast you did a while back talking about different techniques and just the idea of humor. You know, you're talking about Adam Sandler. I think just to actually be in touch with just the joy of laughing at really stupid, silly things. Yep. It's wonderful. And there are all kinds of antidotes to our seriousness. And I'm glad you rented that Harley and headed on out.
Yeah, no, it was, it's funny too. I'm thinking about the last like 6 or 7 months where I have this, I'll be watching something, whether stupid or actually, you know, smart humor. And I'll laugh like really like this, like hysterical laugh that I didn't have a couple of years ago. My wife will go, "What is that?" And I'm like, I don't know. It's funny. Like it's funny. It's stupid and it's funny. And, you know, like I'll even like, we'll be on planes and I'll, yeah, have like a burst out laugh, and it's just something I just wouldn't have, again, like the referee standing over you and saying like, adults, 33-year-old men don't laugh on airplanes, you know what I mean, like that sort of attitude. So it's nice that that's gone. And Steve Ozanich in his book talks, like he has like this checklist of 17 things basically, like that if you have these in mindful practice, like essentially this is the TMS checklist. And yes, and one, yes, of them is being able to laugh at the absurdities and stupidity of life, like that's such a big part of it. And I mean, I even think the other day, like my one-year-old, she crawls over to the coffee table, she stands up, I'm watching like a baseball game or a basketball game or something, she starts banging on the countertop, and then she grabs the remote and then literally turns up the TV and it's blaring and it's blasting. And I feel like 2 years ago, seeing the vocabulary extension, right, I feel like, which I would not have said 2 years ago, but I feel like 2 years ago, I probably would have like gotten so annoyed, like, Audrey, give me the remote. Stop turning it up. Like, I'm trying to watch this thing. But like, I couldn't help it. I'm like bursting out laughing because this one-year-old doesn't even know what she's doing. But the TV is now so loud, the neighbors across the street could probably hear it. And it's, you know, it's just stupid shit. But like that's a big thing that I think a lot of people are missing. There's some of these TMS groups that I'm involved with on Facebook and that I moderate. It's got, I don't know, 2,500 members or something. And there's certain, I'm not like calling anybody out or bashing anybody or things like this, but a lot of what they post is this ultra serious. They'll post like an inspirational meme or something, and it's just so super serious all the time. And it also has a futuristic intent to it, where it says, you know, by the end of 2019, I'm going to be pain-free. And here's this meme that talks about suffering and pain, or they'll say that the last week has been really stressful for me, so that's why my pain is amped up. And I don't know, like I used to really engage in a lot of conversation like that, whether it would be not to talk about my own symptoms or issues or things like that, but almost get in like conversations / arguments about it. But now, like, as I look back, it's just, to me, it's just thinking like, it sounds maybe rough to say, but I feel like maybe they're not grasping this concept, right? It's thinking too much in the future, thinking too much about the end of the road as if this is a destination to get to, as opposed to just being a part of the story. But then also like the concept of I've had a lot of stress in my life the last 2 weeks, and so that's why my pain is amped up. To me, what I feel like that almost implies is that stress is the equal to pain. And so the people that go down that road, they say, I'm going to eliminate stress from my life, then I won't have pain anymore. But that's just not how it works, like at all. And there's been a lot of stories of people that have been, that are now 100% pain-free, that talk about, this is the most stressful time of my life, the period I'm in right now, but I don't have any pain, and the reason for it is because I've recognized these things and I'm feeling my feelings, essentially. So I guess like in your work that you do now, because you're coach, and we're going to get into that in a couple of minutes as we head towards wrapping up, but in the work that you do now, I guess, what, how do you reconcile for people that have maybe a distinction like that, where they say, I know I have pain because my kid stresses me out or my job stresses me out, versus, you know, what it would actually take to eliminate their pain. Talk a little bit about that conflict.
Sure. I also want to say that just parenthetically, that your observation of people who are very, with a lot of sincerity, engaging their own TMS work, the seriousness, the rigidity, the kind of the coercion, the self-coercion, the perfectionism, it's helpful for clients to recognize that in themselves. That is part, and I think you've mentioned this, and it's part of what got us into the problem to begin with. And when we begin to do work on ourselves, in some ways, all we can do is bring into it the skill set that we already have, and to have some realization around that, and also to over time kind of call ourselves out on that and look for ways to kind of loosen up. So I wanted to address that piece that you mentioned.
Yep.
About stress and so on, I think it's a great point. And of course, Sarno makes the point, you know, with the busy housewife, that she says, how can I possibly get better? I got, you know, work, I've got children, I've got my husband to take care of and all this. And he said, you don't have to be, you don't have to change any of it. You just simply have to be aware of it and know that that's causing your symptoms. And it's really true. I think in my own path, I've been undergoing a lot of stress working on a little tiny house project in the last few months. And I began to see weird little symptoms, and I just immediately equated them with the level of stress I was going through. And then they just go away. It's like, you know, after you do this work, and I know you're here too, at this point in the process where and a beautiful, miraculous aspect to this progress that we make is that we tend to not get caught in the symptoms nearly as much, and we can equate it with the stress, and then they just sort of drop away. Or if they don't, we don't worry about it. It's like, oh, yeah, A plus B equals C, so here I am, and so we're not as afraid.
Yep.
And I, in terms of working with stress in people's lives, I really feel like what I say to clients, you know, to anybody, is it is your inner stress that you want to become more aware of, and work with the superego, work with self-compassion, self-intimacy. And it's that, it's knowing it, it's feeling it. It's like what you did with your daughter the other day, and knowing that, and then cognitively connecting it to symptoms. And then I really think the more you do this over time, then the life changes may or may not come as they're guided by this growing internal awareness. Just like you taking the Harley out into the desert. For somebody else, it might be, okay, after a year of doing this work or 6 months, I'm not going to be with this man anymore because right. It's just too nightmarish. Why would I treat myself that way? So I look at it as a kind of a natural, again, a kind of an alignment of the psyche and the soul to make things more more attuned in its own life over time, and that doesn't need to be pushed.
Yeah, definitely. What are some things that you do, that you do with clients? Well, first of all, how do clients find you, and what step in their personal process are they typically by the time that they get to you? Have they been, is it something where they just found Sarno's book, or maybe they haven't found Sarno's book, or are they people that have kind of been kicking the tires for years and nothing's changed? You know, talk about maybe your, and I'm sure you have there's probably a diverse blend, but what do you typically see as like a prototype client?
Most people come to me after they've engaged Dr. Sarno's work or Dr. Schubner's work, some version, for a while. And you can find me at tmspainrelief.com, or you can Google Andy TMS or Andy Sarno Organs. It's pretty easy to find me on Google. I also do a lot of postings on the TMS Wiki forum site as Andy B. So sometimes people find me through there. I think I've done 2,000 postings there over the last 4 or 5 years. So typical client already knows about this and may have some doubts or questions about, yeah, I get this and this and this, but what about this? Or they might say, I've worked through most of my doubts. I think I'm going somewhere, but I want more help in getting more in touch with my feelings. I also, because I work with the inner critic and with self-compassion, that's kind of my specialty within this realm. People will find me that way. Oh, I get it. What you're really good at is the inner critic, and I can tell I've got an inner critic that's really a problem for me, and I think it's connected to my TMS work. So those are some of the ways, and it's great for me. I think, you know, most people that engage this work, it is a self-understanding program, process, and so my ideal client already sort of knows about this, and they want to go deeper.
Do you find that it's usually with the people that are at that period of time where, like, they're aware of the work and they feel like maybe they have done that they've done some of the work, but they're not making the kind of progress that they want? Is it usually like something subtle that maybe they're quote unquote missing, or is it? I mean, what do you tend to find as like where's the deficiency been, and why hasn't the work worked for them, if that makes sense?
The subtle might be another layer, as I kind of said, like, there, you know, we can go down into these different layers of our emotional place, or of our psyche, if you will, wounds and desires and so on. A lot of it is there. People will get done with a session and they'll say, oh, I was aware, say, of my anger, but I was never aware of the grief and the sadness that I did not connect with my father. And so now I will begin to contemplate that. Now I might be able to write a different unsent letter to my father saying that I really wanted him to love me when I was a kid, and that I was sad that he wasn't able to connect with me, and how much he hurt me. And so some of it is kind of the deeper layers, and some of it, and I think for me out in the desert, a lot of it was more on the upper layers, is just, oh, it's that moment-to-moment inner activity of self-rejection and the conflicts around it, the impulse to do something and then the censor to not do it, and then the pressures we put on ourselves, that who we need to think we need to be loved and successful. A lot of times it's just putting a magnifying glass on that, and people say, oh yeah, I'm doing this all day long.
Right. More recognition, more. Yeah. So, I mean, to me, it almost sounds like, even though they're aware of the stuff, aware of the work, they're still in some ways almost going along on autopilot still, that the tendencies aren't changed, the inner critic isn't changed, even just the recognition of the little subtle things in life aren't changed. Because there's a really cool example, I feel like, in one of Dr. Sarno's books, where he's talking about how, you know, the thing that brought you the pain could be the neighbor not saying hello to you at the mailbox.
Yes, yes.
And I think so often we sort of all get caught up in the, I would get stuck for a long time when I would try and be digging out these things from my childhood, which I didn't really, I mean, there were moments and things like that I'm sure are triggering later on. But to me, like, you can trace let me give you a good example. I think I've told this on the podcast before, but basically I would try and find like, an instance of me getting like beaten as a child in my past, and that's where the pain is coming from. it never happened. And so, like, to me, I was like, okay, like, what am I digging for then? And what I would start to find and uncover is, okay, here's where I can make a logical connection. The whole thing too, logical is not the right word because this is about feeling, not about thinking. But one thing that would come to mind might be that in my sales career, I would have to be uber successful, make a certain amount of money, you know, be a high income earner, like that kind of thing. Yes. And if I was not, it meant that I was doing a poor job with my life. Thus, if I don't end up being highly successful in this job, I may turn into not the brother I was talking about earlier, but I have another brother that I'm estranged from. And it, you know, he got into a lot of drugs and alcohol, and I just didn't want to be a part of that. And I kind of felt like he's sort of acting like a loser. Therefore, if I don't perform well in my job, it's going to mean that I'm going to turn into my brother, and these are the things that my brother does. And so, like, I can then make the leap from one place to another. But there are also a lot of, like, daily pressures that I put on myself. And I think that maybe that's part of why later on Sarno amended some of the things that he would suggest people think about and write about, as opposed to it being strictly a childhood thing. It's like, make these lists of one-third child, one-third daily pressure, one-third personality characteristics. Because I would assume, like, there's plenty of people that get TMS. In fact, I think that Dr. Arlene Feinblatt, when I interviewed her, said like 70% of people that she sees don't have a big time type T childhood trauma. For them, it's more the other two lists that is, you know, sort of the genesis of their issues.
Yes, and I think it comes to mind. I think there was a kind of retrospective study that Dr. Sarno did where he pulled all these client files, hundreds of them, and looked at even the ones with trauma. He felt like the work that helped them, or the source of their TMS, I'm forgetting the wording, was really about the moment-to-moment inner relationship, the self, that, you know, we could say it, the self-treatment.
Yep.
And and all of these things are so intertwined when you talk about, you know, not being seen at a party, or somebody doesn't say hello to you, or you thinking about, you know, that fear of not becoming your brother. Those are beautiful ways to talk about it, because what these things do in us, in these tender, vulnerable parts of us and the structures that got formed when we were very young, they evoke all this material that we're really not aware of. And essentially it comes down to is we're not lovable, we may not survive. These are the deepest things that we do not consciously want to feel. And yet those are rolling around all the time. I say that to people, it's, you know, when you have a symptom flare up, you might go back and look at, you know, it may be just the way the cashier looked at you. And all of a sudden you're not aware of it, but it reminds you of some way that you felt in the past. And then it's a feeling of not being loved, or it may just bring up anger, and then there's inner critic activity around that that's even unconscious, and then there's just these psychodynamics. We're born into the world with, we're like defenseless, and we have all these experiences all our lives. And really, even though we have this wonderful ego formation that made us successful and got us through school and keeps us loved by our friends, we're still these very tender, permeable human beings that are feeling these things all the time.
Definitely. And it makes me think of this will be the last story and then we'll wrap up. But I interviewed maybe 3 months ago, 4 months ago, a guy. He's local to Seattle. So I went to his house and we did the interview, which was cool. He's into sports. He lifts weights. He rides, he does cycling, like that kind of thing. And he had years and years of pain. And then he basically read Sarno's book. He would write out like lists of things that were bothering him and stuff like that. He got rid of his pain, and then it came back. It was either several months later or a year or two later, something like that, came back worse than it had ever been before. And he said what made it go away completely was basically like a surrender. You know, he would be a lot, his rugged personality, the way that mine is in a lot of ways, of saying, you know, on the outside, what we're telling people, this is this super ego, the referee side of it, or at least the ego side of it, would be us saying, okay, like we're these independent men and we don't need anybody else and we could live by our, you know, we could live by ourselves in the woods and we don't, you know, we don't need anybody. We don't need relationships. We don't need anything. And he said, basically when he sort of changed that thought pattern of like, you know, no, I still do. I like to be loved. I like people. I like being around others. I like this. He's like, that was like the rapid cessation of the pain. Like almost like right away. And I, and to me, what basically happened is that, that, the ego side of him that said, hey, I don't need anybody versus the child inside of him that said, no, man, I just like, just, I just want to hug. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like those intersecting is okay. There's the spark of the pain. And then once when he, you know, when you remove the mirror and they're now looking at each other through a window and like, hey, we're the same person. We have the same goals. We, you know, we want the same kinds of things. The pain, he snapped right out of it. Like it was really pretty. And one thing I'm thinking of too, that, that your story makes me think of a little bit is there's a guy who lives out in Colorado. His name's Jeremy Whitaker. I interviewed him as well. He's got still my favorite recovery story to this day, but he had been meditating daily for like 15 years in an excruciating back pain for the longest time. And then he read Sarno's book, and like his first meditation session after he finished Sarno's book, his pain vanished. And I was thinking, like, you had all these, you had this tool that you were doing for a long time that wasn't giving you any relief, and then you integrated the Sarno work and the TMS idea and the idea of repressed emotions, and did that, you know, intersected that with the tool you've been using for a long time, and like poof, everything comes together. It's really pretty interesting work. So as we wrap, you mentioned the website earlier, but tell us again where people can find you. Are you taking new clients? Like what's the interaction look like, and how can people reach you if they want to work with you?
Sure. It's tmspainrelief.com. And there's a contact page on that website. They can contact me through that, through an email. And I can chat with them on the phone a little bit, see if we're a good fit, and go from there.
Terrific. Thank you so much for your time. Andy, stay on the line after we I've been realizing as I record these interviews, we'll say our goodbyes for the recording, and then before I can say, wait, don't hang up, they've already hung up. So hang on the line here. but thanks so much for joining the podcast. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you. And you're doing such great work with the variety of your own self-disclosure and the variety of people you're interviewing. It's like we're right along the journey with you. So this makes it really potent what you're doing.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much. Cool. All right. Well, yeah, thanks so much again for the interview, and maybe we'll do a catch-up show at some point in the future.
Okay, great. Awesome. Thank you.